Sounds like I should fill that awkward silence. A joke? Yeah? I don't know, James is... He can't decide whether I've started or not. He's putting the music up, he's putting the music down. This could be fun. All right, we'll get started. Morning, everyone. Thanks for coming along to the first session. I guess I'm lucky that I'm not the first session after the party, so I'm grateful for that. Who was over in the arena yesterday for my first session? Oh, cool. All right, that's awesome. What we're going to do today is really talk more about the rules and regulations, I guess, of designing Windows 8 and Windows Phone applications. Yesterday, we sort of talked about the sort of philosophy and principles behind the design languages, I tried to share with you guys sort of how you might be able to apply those same philosophies and principles to the design of your apps. Today it's more about the rules. I guess the first thing to say is there are a lot of rules and you don't really want me to read them out to you. So what I want to do is sort of walk through sort of some of the main points that I think you guys should be keeping in mind as you start to think about the actual arrangement of information and functionality across your apps and the layout on the page. Just some things to be aware of based on our experience at least. So that's what you've got yourselves into today. Thanks for that. Same two intro slides as yesterday. I run a little UX design agency called Automatic Studio. We do UX design and mentoring, not just on the Microsoft platform, but we do a lot of Microsoft work. Here's some of our phone work. We also, recently, the NAB phone app came out. I need to add that to the brag book. We're working on a bunch of Windows 8, two or three Windows 8 apps that we can't show you yet. But I did work with the Xamlin guys on SBS and with 9MSN on TV Fix. As I said, a couple more underway, and I'll talk about some of our learnings from that as we go. What about you guys? Who's actually started building or designing a Windows 8 or a Windows Phone app? Okay. And who thinks they might be doing that sometime in the next year? Okay, I would imagine, given that you're all here. That's awesome. Who's a designer? We're starting to infiltrate the tech ed crowd. That's awesome, guys. Alrighty, let's move on. To recap, yesterday we talked about five design language principles. These are the principles for Windows 8. There's five principles for Windows Phone. I probably should have included those as well. They're similar but slightly different, just to add to the confusion. We talked about pride in craftsmanship means sweating the details and making sure we create an app that is professional responsive and something we can be proud of. Fast and fluid was about responsive again, and the importance of animation in Windows 8 and in particularly in Windows Phone. This idea of authentically digital was where a lot of the design aspects, like the minimalist controls or the lack of controls altogether, using the content as the controls rather than decorating our content with controls. Do more with less was about picking that one thing that you're good at and doing that well, rather than trying to be all things to all people. And we talked yesterday about your best app statement. I'm going to ask you guys again to, if you could, shimmy in towards the middle so we free up some seats on the aisles. We talked about your best app statement, that one sentence that describes what your app's going to be best at. And even if you're in a competitive space, You want to be able to say what's going to differentiate your app from other apps. And the last one was Winners One, and this is Microsoft really asking us to respect the standards and conventions of the platform, things like the charms in the charms bar, and also the UI conventions, so that that the platform sort of moves forward with a sort of consistency from which we all benefit. If users start to recognize what constitutes a well-designed or a well-built Windows Phone or Windows 8 app, that's good for all of us. But we all have to work together to do that. And that also means leveraging the charms, particularly the share charm, and making our apps all work together. Just a bit more recap. We did a bit of sort of design history. We talked about three sort of design movements and plus wayfinding signages as inspiration influences behind the design languages for the phone and for Windows 8. We talked about the first two, in particular Bauhaus and the International School. We talked about how they're design philosophies that are very rational, that they're based on understanding the structure of the information that we're trying to present and the purpose of the tasks that we're trying to support, and using those two things to derive our user interface. So rather than starting with the visuals or thinking about fonts and colours and layout, these rational design schools start with how should our information be structured, how can our information be best presented, and using that to reveal the right structure for your app. There's some seats down the front, guys. Oh, g'day, mate. Some of the sort of, I think this is the last recap slide. We talked about some of the, what I consider to be the key characteristics of the platform. And I divided them up into sort of things that are about visuals, which is probably what we expect, things that are about the interaction style, how people interact with our applications, and things that are about arranging and organizing information in our across our apps and within our individual page. And these are sort of some of the unique features, right? So visually, you've noticed that the design language is all about flat rectangles of color, not very much 3D, not a lot of those, you know, gradients and glossy treatments that we might be used to designing into our apps, particularly our mobile apps. A lot of emphasis and use of typography, so not a lot of iconography, but instead lots and lots of text, right? And white space is really key. I'm going to come back to this later, but by white space we mean empty space. Can come in any color you like. It's the gaps between the elements on your page that help users group and organize the stuff in their head. I'm going to come back to it, so I'll save the rest of that talk for later. We talked yesterday about the panoramas, both on the phone and on Windows 8, and how, because they're seamless, they just seem to be a very sort of natural and, dare I say, delightful way for people to sort of get an overall view of the of an application or a page. They rely on our visual memory and our spatial memory. We sort of the intention is that as I move across the panorama, I remember what was over there, because it's as if I'd turned my head over here. I can always turn my head back. In terms of interactivity, you know, the big deal is a lack of controls. Not that those controls don't exist. There's plenty of controls there. There's all the controls you expect: combo boxes and text boxes and password boxes and check boxes and radio buttons and all that sort of stuff. By lack of control, I mean we're encouraged not to sprinkle them through the actual screens. There's some seats down the front in the second aisle here. And then we talked a bit about animation. I'm going to cover animation a bit again today, and the importance of using animation to orient people inside our application. So as things move and change and open and fold, what we're doing is we're creating a mental model for users of how they're moving through the application. And that's more important on the phone than it is probably for Windows 8, because at the end of the day, the phone is a smaller screen. We talked about this yesterday. And so there's less pixels available to us to provide those orientation cues. Traditionally, on a website, we have nav bars and breadcrumbs and other sorts of elements that are not the content that the user has come here for, but help the user understand where this content fits in the broader context. Because we have less pixels to play with, we need to focus on content. And animation is an important cue that we use with the turnstile animation on the phone and stuff like that that help the user understand the journey that they're taking. We didn't talk too much about live tiles yesterday, but they're quite a unique element, obviously, of these two platforms. And they're ways for your content to sort of peek out from your application. In the question and answer time yesterday, we talked about thinking about your live tile like a shop window. And if someone was walking along the street past your shop, what is it that you'd put in the window of your shop to get them to come in and visit? And those are the sorts of things that you might want to expose on your live tiles. Something that's quite unique to Windows 8, if you're in touch mode, is the edge swipes. Yeah, those gestures that off the edge that pull in the charms bar here on the right, or pull in the app bar. I won't have an app bar on this. That's quite a unique gesture. And I think it's tempting for us to try and compensate for the hiddenness of those gestures and move things onto our screen. And so a lot of the discussions that we're having with our clients at the moment is trying to reassure them that they don't need to put the stuff that's in the app bar or in the charms bar onto their page as well. And that's a journey we're all on together. Panoramic views are not just about visual design, but they're also about a very different interaction style, particularly when we think about semantic zoom. And lastly, information design. Live tiles I put under information design as well, because we now have to start to think about how we're going to distribute information between a small tile, a large tile, a snapped view, a filled view, and possibly even a desktop application. And what's the distribution of information and functionality across that continuum. We don't just design apps to be open and closed anymore. We design apps to be more or less open or more or less closed across that continuum from live tile or even notification all the way through to a full screen app or a desktop app. So those are some of the key points from yesterday. Some of those points will come up again in the slides as we go through today. I guess the thing is that Metro maybe is deceptively easy. I said Metro. I'm not giving out cups again. There are some cups back here, but that was a big mistake. When you look at particularly the best designed apps for the platform, because they're not particularly visually rich, I think it's easy to think that I could do this. And to a certain extent, that's true. I think what Microsoft has done really well is provide for us a design language that is approachable, because it's not esoteric in terms of its decoration. When you approach it, you think, well, I can take some text, I can organize it into an information structure, I can lay it out on a page, I can make sure I get the right font sizes and stuff like that. It's very approachable, and I think that's a good thing. I think that helps all of us get up to a minimum standard. I guess the challenge is the converse of that statement, that we actually don't have a very sort of replete arsenal of devices on screen that we can use to direct people's attention, to help them understand what it is we want them to do or what will happen when they do stuff. And we talked yesterday that because the visual language is very sort of flat, invoking an emotional response is possibly a bit harder. And we also talked about branding yesterday and how a lot of organizations are initially nervous about how to represent their brand on such a minimalist platform. And we talked yesterday about how brand is more than just your colors, your fonts, and your logos, and how what we do with our organizations is talk about how we can reinforce their brand through a great experience, through a great conversation that happens over time, rather than just with plastering your application with logos. I'm only going to do this one more time, guys. If you could possibly squeeze in, there's a bunch of people standing up the back who'd love to come down and get a seat. Thanks, everyone. So we tend to approach the UI design language as an exercise in choosing fonts, getting the right styling, the right separation, using the right grid, all that sort of stuff. But as we said yesterday, designing the right user experience for these platforms is not just about working out where to put the pixels. And so rather than starting with the visuals, we start at the bottom of this list. We start with what is our intention, what is it that we want to get people to do, and how do we want them to feel about it when they do it. Then we can talk about information design, how to structure our application, not just within a page or a screen, but also across multiple pages and screens. Then we can think about what are the right widgets, or in our case, less about widgets and more about what are the right interactions, the right gestures, the right other interactive elements that will allow users to interact with our content. And lastly, we need to worry about visuals. I don't say lastly because it's not the most important, but because the main job of our visual design is to communicate to the user all the good work we've already done in terms of information design and interaction design. Yes, our visuals need to be aesthetically pleasing, but they have a much more important role than just being pretty, and that's communicating everything that's going on behind the scenes in an appropriate way. So there it is. Like all good design, designing for Windows 8 or Windows Phone does not start with visuals. Having said that, we're going to talk mainly about... I'm in presentation mode. Why am I getting Skype notifications? Having said that, we're going to focus on layout. So these are the 7 steps that are up on design.windows.com in the section about planning your app. Microsoft encourages us to sort of follow these steps to organize our user experience. So like I was saying, you know, visuals don't come till, you know, more than halfway down the list. First you need to work out what you're trying to achieve. Then you need to understand what the task flows are. And previous years at here at TechEd, we've talked about the importance of mapping out the tasks, mapping out the journey that we want our users to take through our application before we worry about visuals. I like number 4, decide how you're going to make money from it. We've skipped that step, and we're going to talk more about the rules and regulations, as I said. So we saw those 4 layers again in a different format. Yesterday we sort of talked about the principles behind and how you can use that to inspire the concept and the intention of your application. Today we're going to muck around in the inner 3 layers. So like I said, there's too many rules for me to just read out for you, and to be honest, that would be boring anyway. So all the rules for Windows 8 are at design.windows.com. Microsoft has actually done a pretty good job. It's been evolving over time too, so if you haven't been there for a while, check back every once in a while. I often get surprised. I go back and the content's been embellished, or there's a lot of good examples and case studies there. If you're coming from iPad, there's a couple of good case studies. Well, there's one good case study on how to move from an iPad design to a Windows 8 design and what things you might need to consider. And there's also a good case study coming from a website and what you might need to consider if you're converting a website into a Windows 8 application. If you're designing for the phone, there's also plenty of resources for you too, but as far as I can tell, there's no friendly URL, but it's all there. Or if you go to windowsphone.com, you can, with a few clicks, you'll find your way to the user experience guidelines. So what I'm going to do today is pick out, I guess, some of the key things to bear in mind. You can always go back to these resources to get the exact rules. And speaking of rules, I guess one thing to bear in mind, because it's come up a few times in sort of questions that people have asked me in the corridors and stuff, the UX guidelines do is sort of say these are the things that you must or should do to be a well-designed, well-behaved app. Oftentimes I get questions like, would we be allowed to do this or that? And they're hard questions to answer, because what there isn't is on these guidelines is a list of things that you're not allowed to do. So it requires a certain amount of interpretation. So as well as looking at the individual rules, I think it's worth bearing in mind sort of just trying to understand the overall vibe, should I say, of the design language and what seems to fit. What feels like it fits on the application, on the platform, and what doesn't. Right. Let's start with some stuff about designing navigation in particular, and using our visual arsenal to reveal structure, to reveal information. There's pretty much the navigation models on the phone and on Windows 8 are usually not challenging. So long as your app is not too rich in terms of its features, there's a couple of models that that we can use. I was saying before that we have fewer devices available to on-screen orient people inside the application, and it's really the journey that they took from the front page down into your content or functionality that is the device that we use to help people keep track of where they are. And so the hub or the panorama, it's called a hub in Windows 8 and a panorama in Windows Phone. Why do they have different names? I don't know. Have a very important role, and they have two roles, really. So I should say that pretty much every app that you build is going to start with a panorama. I think Microsoft would encourage us to think about alternatives, and there have certainly been some apps that we have, the Lonely Planet app, for example, there have been some apps that where we decided not to start with a panorama, but it's to the point where people kind of expect their app to start with a panorama, and I think that's okay. It needs to serve two purposes. It needs to service people's browsing behavior. What have you got? What can I see? Tell me more about your app. As well as their searching behavior. When they return to the app, they're likely to be more focused on, I know this app well, and what I want to find out today is what updates have there been in my social network, or what's the price of that stock, or how are our sales going? They've got a specific activity that they want to achieve when they return to your app later. And so you've got to find the right balance between browsy stuff, which tends to mean bubbling up sample content up onto the panorama to pique people's interest and to give a taste of what's deeper in the application, as well as supporting sort of more directed searching type activities. So a couple of sort of canonical, dare I say, navigation models coming up in a sec. The first point is to say that we want people to navigate using the content. So we want them to basically tap on the stuff on our home screen to drill deeper into the application rather than using menu bars or you know, tabs or drop-down menus. All those things are available to us, but you know, the general guidance is that we should avoid those wherever we can. Instead, let people navigate the application by clicking on content and opening up layers. If we do need navigation that the content itself can't support, the guidance for Windows 8 is that we should use the top app bar. So when you pull down, let's have a look at that. When you open up a typical app, the app bar at the bottom, we're going to come to this in a minute, but there's more specific rules about what we're allowed to do in the app bar at the bottom, and most particularly, we're only allowed to populate it with these button styles. Whereas at the top, we're freer to do whatever we need to do. So there's a slide coming up about this, but the general guidance is at the bottom are the buttons that allow us to perform some action related to the current content, whereas at the top are sort of more global functions that are less about the current page and more about the app as a whole, and in particular navigation. Not necessarily trying to promote the weather app as great design of a top-level nav bar. I reckon that looks pretty ugly. I don't know what you guys think. It almost looks like a mistake. What could they do to make that look better? Sorry?
They look like tiles when they're not tiles.
Yeah, they do look like tiles, and they don't even look like particularly attractive tiles for some reason. I think they're not respecting, you know, Metro's reliance on type. I would have made the labels much bigger. I mean, the icons are pretty much meaningless anyway. Keep the icons there for a bit of visual differentiation, but at that size, they're kind of sparse and there's not enough detail to justify that much size. I would have put more text and less icon. The other problem that they have is that the icons, those three icons don't sit well together because they have there's a lot of variation in detail. Like the world map has a lot of detail and, you know, sort of irregular lines, whereas the star has, you know, very little going on at all. So they don't balance well beside each other. Anyway, that was kind of, I went off script there for a minute. The main forms of navigation that we'll see on the page are the back button. So when you drill into a typical application, you get the back button at the top left there. Does what you expect, goes back. And the other form of navigation that they authorise on the homepage are context menus off the main heading. That same thing happened to me yesterday. What else has got a context menu? That was going to be my example. There's a slide coming up about it, but basically next to the heading, you can have a little, like a V, a chevron, and you can drop down a menu from that, which allows you to do horizontal navigation. There's a slide coming up. On the phone, pretty much, as I said, everything starts with a panorama. And there's some guidance there for structuring and organizing your content. On the phone, we're often faced with this conundrum we need to sort of represent some sort of menu as well as sort of browsy content. So this is Facebook's answer to balancing browsy stuff with searchy stuff. This is the browsy stuff, what's going on. This is the searchy stuff. No, I specifically need to find out something about an event. Whether you put that searchy stuff first or the browsy stuff first in the panorama, you need to think about really the context of use and what people are trying to achieve, I'd suggest. So let's face it, pretty much every phone app goes from a panorama to a series of pivot pages to a series of content pages. Pivot, like this guy over here, is these, if you've used the phone, you swipe across, and they're sort of like, it's the Metro version of tabs. You swipe across those headings at the top, and each new page slots into place. The guidance around using pivots is that we should use them like tabs. They should be different views of the same content. So generally speaking, we want to avoid using pivots where each topic is completely new content, but instead they're different, sorting or filtering of the same content. So in the email application, for example, you've got your inbox and you've got unread and I think you've got some other stuff. They're different views of the same content rather than completely different content. Interestingly, the pivot as such doesn't exist officially on Windows 8, and I've even spoken to some of the some of the folks who are putting together the UX guidance for Windows 8, and they're trying to say don't use pivots. I'm not actually convinced. I think, and there are places where it's just been very natural for us to use pivots or pivot-like devices. But the official guidance is we shouldn't use them. Although it's not even official. There's nothing on the website. There's nothing that says don't use a pivot. But neither pivots are never mentioned either. So interpret that how you will. So that was a couple of slides about the phone. On Windows 8, basically, there's two sort of canonical navigation structures: traditional, hierarchical, drill through the tree of content and functionality, much like a website, or a flat structure. Probably 90% of apps follow the first model. And the thing I would say about that hierarchical structure is because of that lack of stuff, Chrome around the edge to tell you where you are, you really don't want to go deeper than two or three levels into your application. And if you're finding that your information hierarchy is four or five or six or more levels deep, I guess you need to ask yourself two questions. Have I overreached in terms of the richness of this application? Or if I can't avoid that deep structure, need to think about ways that you can sort of pull that structure up so that while you still have those seven layers, they probably only appear across three layers of screen. And there's a couple of different ways you can do that. And the beauty of the panorama is that it's possible to have a very wide top-level structure. Normally, we say sort of seven-ish top-level categories is ideal. But this is just Shane's opinion. Because of the sort of very spatial nature of that seamless panorama, I think you can get away with more categories. You probably would want to make each category sort of skinnier, but you can probably go to more different categories on the top level. So that's one way you can make your structure sort of shallower. Another way to make your structure shallower is to sort of combine two levels on the one page. And that's a place where you might use a pivot, for example. So you've arrived at a page, and across the top we have effectively a level of navigation, just words as headings, and you do see this on a few apps, so that you actually flip around between effectively two levels of the hierarchy on one page. There's other things you can do, like master-child type views, where you might have a scrolling list of options. I don't like this as much, but you might have a scrolling list of options down the left-hand side of the screen, for example. So that's one level of your hierarchy, and as you select each one, you can show the detail of that element in the body of the, or in the balance of the page. And these are all the tricks that we use, not just for Metro, but for websites and all sorts of applications to sort of try and flatten the hierarchy. I beg your pardon? Yeah, I think the question was, can you mix both of them? And I think that's a really good point. So just to sort of, by flat, we basically mean some sort of journey that is a linear backwards and forwards, or that there just is no structure to. So, IE would be an example of that. We don't want to play the video, thank you. If I had more tabs open, those tabs across the top are basically the navigation structure for IE. So that's a flat navigation, there's no hierarchy to it. Or if you're navigating content like a book, or content that has a linear structure like a training course, or filling out forms and stuff, then you'll have sort of a linear structure. I think it's, coming back to the question, can you mix them up? I think absolutely you can. The most likely model is going to be that your overall structure is hierarchical, but at certain points it makes sense to swap to a different structure. And the only thing I'm just thinking out loud, you want to make sure that it's clear to your users that change has happened. And sometimes the nature of the content itself will make that clear. If you've dropped into a sort of a document or a wizard because you're filling out a credit card application, then the content itself will pretty much signal to you that we're now in a linear mode. But just be conscious of that people have been drilling in, and then suddenly you want them to sort of navigate this way. Have you made that clear to them? So sort of teasing out that hierarchical view, this is straight from the Microsoft website. They suggest that your structure goes like this. You have a hub page at the top. You have what they call a section page, which is basically a hub but possibly is less about browsy and more about searchy. And then eventually you arrive at some sort of detail page where you see the detailed content or you perform a particular function. That's the canonical navigation model, and we're using the back button to get back up to the top. And we don't typically provide a lot of tools for our users to navigate sideways. So on a website where you might have quite a detailed nav bar, and you might even have a two-level sort of a tree menu down the left-hand side of your website, is something we wouldn't typically do for Metro. So here's another example, sort of a more fleshed out example from the Microsoft site. And so you can see a couple of conventions happening here. The title of a group up in the hub should be navigation down to the full details of that group. My informal testing suggests that people don't necessarily expect that. So here's a case where we're faced with a conundrum. Do we toe the line in the hope that users as a whole will get that, or do we cheat a little bit and provide some specific cues? So you've probably seen applications that do one of two things. Let's say you're looking at my wish list there. They might, in small text next to it, say all items or more items or something as a cue to say if you tapped here, you'd get more items. Is that against the Metro rules? Once again, I haven't read a rule that says you must not do that, but by the same token, you might argue that explicit content that is not content that is instructions, is possibly sort of frowned upon. There is a general rule around help that we shouldn't provide help on the screen, that the application should be self-explanatory. So was that help? If we put more or all items, was that some sort of help? I don't know. The other thing we see people do is they add a tile to the end maybe of the grid there that is more or all or something like that. I think that's quite cute. Probably has the same problems in terms of should you do it. But I quite like the idea that you might mix up the grid with an element that's not a photo or not content, but is instead a piece of navigation. I think it's really easy if a lot of applications have the problem that they start laying out or populating that top level panorama and it all looks the same. So you really have to ask yourself, how can I mix it up? And quite deliberately, even if the optimal presentation is pretty much the same for every grouping, ask yourself what devices you could use to mix it up. A side-by-side layout with a picture and some text, a stacking layout rather than tiles, pulling out some feature elements and just giving them more prominence. What you're doing is you're creating a different visual silhouette for each of the sections in your panorama, so they don't all look the same. And that's really useful for our users when they're doing that scrolly thing, because they can be looking for that shape or those outline shapes that will help them find the section that they're looking for. If everything looks the same, they kind of have to stop and read the content or read the headings to work out what section they're looking at. Down into your sort of full list of content for a section, and then eventually down into your actual content. Does that make sense? Yeah? Sorry.
You said that users don't, in your testing, you found that users don't always expect to get this navigation structure?
From the headings, yeah.
Yeah, so what did they expect?
Well, they looked around for... That's a good question. I guess I'm just sort of trying to summarize across a few different tests in my head. In some cases, there was a risk that people thought that was all the content. And for those things, I think it was even more important to add an extra tile at the end to suggest there is more. This is just a sample. People sort of figured there should be more because they knew the domain well enough. It was a question of how do I get to it? And I'm just trying to think, did people... I can't remember exactly. I can't sort of quote anything specific, but I guess the question to be asked is whether it eventually occurs to people to tap on that heading. Yeah. Just trying to think. Right, so that's the point, right? You know, as people become more used to the platform and the conventions of it, they'll naturally start doing this sort of stuff. And this is where Microsoft says we need to win as one. You know, they're kind of trying to, it's a bit of a sort of a rallying cry. They want us to hold the line. Particularly in the initial wave of applications, they want us to sort of enforce these conventions. Because if one of us breaks ranks, if I could use that analogy, then that's the beginning of the end. That's a little bit too excessive, but I totally know talking to my clients, you know, they're like, and I'm saying, let's think of an example. Oh, we can't have, we're not supposed to have this help content on the page. It's supposed to be in the settings panel, and they're like, but our users, you know, will need this help content. Can't we be the exception? Now, I don't know how to it's really not my job to sort of advocate the entire platform. So it's really tough for me to answer those questions. But for the platform as a whole, it's actually to our advantage to try and stick to these conventions. And when you think about, when you think about the iPhone, for example, or particularly the iPhone, less so Android, because the conventions are more or less well adhered to for whatever reason. If you're an iPhone user and you load a new app that is unconventional in terms of its use of the controls or its layout or presentation, you actually have this moment of, do I trust these people? You know, this is not the same. We're going to be faced over time with some of the same questions. Hopefully. People will become so used to the conventions that if you stray from those conventions, you're going to need to have a good reason. We're on a bit of a journey together. I'll report in next year. Kind of talked about flat navigation. Basically, there's no hierarchy to it. There's a series of topics to choose from, either with an implied order or not. Kind of covered that. A little bit about the back button. For Windows 8, it's actually pretty simple. The back button goes back. On the phone, we use the hardware back button, and we're not supposed to provide any navigation on the screen. We're supposed to leave it to the user to just use the physical hardware back button to get back to home and then find their way back into somewhere else. That's the guidance. I'm sure you can think of cases where you want to break that rule. Often we get asked if you're allowed to manipulate the back stack. The answer is yes. If you've gone through a series of steps and someone presses back, it might not make sense to literally backtrack through those steps. And the obvious example is you're in some sort of wizard. you're filling out forms in a series of steps. They've got to the end. Their home loan application is complete, if someone's crazy enough to apply for a home loan on a phone. And when they press back, it's not appropriate, obviously, to take them back to the last step of their home loan application. By back, they mean all the way back to the step before. And so we're allowed to manipulate the behaviour of back in that way, but obviously back shouldn't take them to a place they've never been. And then live tiles, home button is discouraged, just to say that out loud. Live tiles that deep link into your application, Microsoft tells us we shouldn't provide. The back button should go back out to the start screen, not back up the application hierarchy. And we've struggled with that with some of our apps. You've pinned some content. Let's say it's the Qantas app. You've pinned your flight to the front page. When you drill into that flight from the live tile on the start screen, we did have some debate internally about shouldn't we provide our users with a way to get back up to the top screen of the Qantas app from that page. The guidance from Microsoft, and we stuck with it, is no. That back takes you back to the start screen. If users want to get to the top of your app, they open the app itself. So that's officially what we're supposed to do. It seems to be working okay. Because you can, the converse argument is that's kind of unpredictable. That I've arrived somewhere deep in the site, and the hardware back button doesn't go back where I came from, but instead starts taking me up the stack of the application. And would rely on me to be sufficiently familiar with the application to not be kind of alarmed by that behaviour. So the back button is more nuanced on the phone, as it turns out, than for Windows 8.
Sorry, does the home button discourage apply to the Windows 8 platform as well?
I haven't read anything to that effect, but I would bet. We just saw one in the weather app, didn't we? Didn't we? Yeah. The weather app is actually interesting I haven't pinned Melbourne. That's the app tile that just happens to be showing me the weather in Melbourne. And generally, when you open it, you actually arrive deep in the app. I'm glad you pointed this out. I'm just realizing this now. So much like on the phone, they're not offering us a back button here, but in fact, in the nav bar, they're letting us go home. Hello? Oh, there. Oh, okay. This is home. Did you see that? I go into Melbourne, I get a back button, I press back. This is the home page, which happens to be Melbourne. Well, actually, I'm glad someone said it looks like it was the first app made. I think this is really important, actually. A lot of the early apps that came out before the guidance was finished. So, because a few times, clients have said, oh, but the weather app or the news app or whatever does that. And I'm like, yeah, that's a shame. this app does some interesting things, some stuff that, you might not have expected by embedding controls, right? I'm not sure that they should have this left and right arrow. Instead, what they should have done is animate that content in so that we saw that it scrolls and then wait for us to do horizontal scrolling, except we're not allowed to have horizontal scrolling inside horizontal scrolling. So what would you have done instead? Maybe you needed to... I'm just making this up as I go along. Maybe you needed to position this content vertically so that you can scroll it vertically as well as pan the panorama horizontally, he says, making stuff up on the fly. Good question, thank you. Meanwhile, back at the slides. Where are they? Um... Here's the header menu that I was talking about before. So on the header of the page, we can add this little chevron, which drops down a flyout. This is a flyout. And in there, we can offer horizontal navigation. And interestingly, which I hadn't thought about before, they've offered a home link in there. And that's straight off the standard, off the UX guidance. So there you go. I'd never registered that there was a home link there before. So here's a screenshot of the SBS app using that sort of chevron device to let you navigate from arts to sport, or more importantly, from sports to art. We talked about this a bit yesterday, that what our on-screen design should try to do is to reveal the structure of the information that it's trying to present. And there's no one answer to that. All information is different. We saw this slide yesterday. The idea from the Swiss school is that if you sort of understand and decompose the structure of your information, and then as a baseline, you then present that information so its structure is clear, then you're well on your way to good design, according to our friends at the Swiss school. And certainly, if you're designing for Metro, it's very, very similar. If you structure your content well, you'll make a beautiful page, not just because it's aesthetically beautiful, because it's easy to process, but because it's satisfying, because it's easy to process. And so we were saying yesterday that even if you don't speak German, you can see the structure of this poster, and you can see that there's a hierarchy of information. You know, clearly at the top level of the hierarchy is the name of the theatre. Then I would argue that the next level of the hierarchy is the name of the festival at the top, and then there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 somethings. We don't even need to know what they are. Turns out they're performances or shows. And then within that, you can see that there's 3 categories of information. Over here, doesn't even matter what it is. There's something. And over here, there's 2 categories of or 2 groupings of other information. So we refer to this as the visual hierarchy. And the visual hierarchy, the main job of the visual hierarchy is to actually represent the information hierarchy, as this page hopefully does. Can I just ask, by the way, I said the section at the top was the second level of the hierarchy, which is interesting because normally we read a page left, right, top to bottom. And often when you're first laying out your content, I would advise you to do that as a starting proposition. Left, right, top to bottom, highest level to lowest level is a good start. How do they get away with putting the they've put the festival name at the top in the same font as the individual program items and aligned with the individual program items? So what made me say that was the second level and not this stuff? It doesn't have the detail. Exactly right. So this is an example of using white space to convey meaning, right? The white space around it allows us to focus our attention on that, and it tells us because it looks different to the others, we're going to treat it differently. Plus, there's a big heading in the middle. So if you've worked with visual designers, one of the things that they often do is let's say this is a screen, is that they'll sort of stand back from it and squint at it. And what they're trying to do, you can do it all now, squint at this poster. I'll just take a short photo, it's always fun. To make sure that the groupings make sense, even when you can't read the text, can I see some logical groupings? And if I was flying 30,000 feet above this screen, would I be able to see the hierarchy of the information without even being able to read what's in that? And you can imagine that the intention here is that I at the highest level, I see the name of the theatre. If I was in that plane and I flew down a little bit, the next level I'd see that there's these 5 groupings, say. I'll skip the thing at the top for a sec. And the big text allows me to work out which one of those I'm interested in, and then fly in even deeper to reveal more content. So there's a It's quite a nice analogy to use when you're laying out your page. Imagine users are 30,000 feet above it. They're going to pick an area to fly into, get more detail, pick an area to fly into and get more detail. And that's how you'll use font size to express your visual hierarchy. And it's pretty, I mean, you know, for me to say big means high, you know, means heading, you guys know that. But that's exactly what's going on here. So here's a more complex page from the finance app. And you can see there's an information hierarchy going on here that's being expressed pretty much just through the use of type and white space. So bigger type represents some sort of summative or heading information. Smaller type means detail. And they're using alignment and grouping and white space to help you chunk up the information. So if you squinted at this page, you could see some basic groupings of information, hopefully. And they're more or less saying, read this page from the top left to the bottom right. What are you looking at? Under indices, you're looking at the ASX 200. The most important thing to know is that it's up 4,000 points. If you read sort of down through here, here's the detail that you've possibly come for. And in the bottom right is the stuff that you might need to refer to. In this case, what time was this? It's interesting that it is a type of navigation. The views to filter this content are underneath the content. Typically, when we'd lay something out, we'd want to, for what we call the hierarchy of control, we'd present that before the content to sort of represent the hierarchy. Manipulating this manipulates that. By laying it out like this, what the designer has decided is that they'd rather you, I think you'd more likely to want to process this information first and then decide how you want to move on from the journey. And by doing that, they've kind of done that content first thing that we want to do with Metro anyway. Thanks for that. And they're not the same time. Oh, there's a trader in our midst. Well, that can't be right because it can't be 4:11 in one place and 1:55 somewhere else. Oh, you know what it is? That's the top. That's this line here. Okay, that's interesting. So there's an interesting piece of design an interesting design decision going on there that certainly wasn't clear to me. Let's talk about that. How could they have created a better relationship between the line here and that date? Yeah, I wonder if they could have laid this out better so that the date was up here and followed it across. I mean, if we move this guy, there's plenty of space for it to just follow it across, right? And then we use proximity to create that relationship.
Depends on the flow that a user would use. So if you move that text, it just becomes very busy, chunky when it moves.
Yeah, maybe.
Use colour.
Yeah, colour or some sort of symbol, you know. A little, you know, coloured rhombus here. And the same little coloured rhombus next to that might be enough to create that relation.
What actually happens when you move the line? There might be an animation that highlights that time.
Maybe. We could test that, but I'm going to keep moving. In fact, we're coming to the end. Oh, that's interesting. I've got a fair bit more content. So we've been talking about information design. Let's talk a little bit about interaction design. Is it really 9:15? So we already know that what Microsoft wants to do is, rather than provide Chrome, the controls, the widgets, the buttons and text boxes and stuff, they want us to try and use the content as the user interface. So this is one of their catchphrases, content before Chrome. That means that the content has to be the user interface and that our users are going to use gestures, tapping, swiping, and stuff, to manipulate that content and then find their way around in the application. What that means is that we have to be trustworthy. We talked about this yesterday. Because there's very little on screen to say what would happen if you tapped me or dragged me or whatever, we have to be trustworthy. We have to behave in such a way that users can confidently tap on these things and know that they're not going to do any harm, because we're asking them to explore. Now, sometimes it'll be probably in this example, it's pretty obvious. I'm going to see the details of these products. But in other cases, what we're asking users to do is tap on stuff, learn how the application works, and the only way they'll do that is if they trust us not to do something bad, not to delete their content or transfer their funds or buy that plane ticket that they didn't expect to buy. So we have to be trustworthy for this whole thing to work. As we've already said, commands have to move down into the app bar down the bottom. The price we pay for that, we talked about this yesterday too, I think, is that it's not as easy for us to associate these commands with specific elements on the page. What Microsoft says is that over here on the bottom right should be the controls that apply to the whole page, whereas on the bottom left, the tendency should be that they should relate to the current selection. So if you've made a selection or if you've focused some element on the page, down on the bottom left are controls specifically about that selection. But there's a slide about this coming up, but I'll say it now so I can skip it. They also say that you should divide your application icons between left and right just so they're easy to get at with your thumb. And they tell us that inject elements or items on the left as they become relevant. So when you combine, if you take all the rules for laying out application buttons and you combine them together, it's clearly impossible to apply all the rules. So some sort of compromise has to happen. But general guidance is this applies to the whole page, like committing, buying, saving. This applies to the current selection or manipulating the view on the current page, generally speaking. You can have a look at this on this is an example on the website, so I'll let you look at it in detail. But this is Microsoft's little case study of taking away that Chrome and letting the content take the fore. So this is an imaginary RSS reader. The interesting thing about it is the content gets about less than a quarter, maybe a fifth of the real estate, and the rest of it is navigation and manipulation and Chrome. And what Microsoft wants us to do first is sort of flatten out the visuals would be the first thing, so that the content can come to the fore. But more importantly, we need to start moving the controls and the navigation out of the page. So we want to use the app bar instead to take all that the search and that sort of stuff off the page. So filtering and manipulating the content down the bottom, use the search charm in particular to hide all that search stuff so that we've got more real estate available for content. But this is not the final state either, because we've still got navigation here, whereas if we use a panorama, we might take that navigation out. Oh, sorry, there's a step before, which is to remove the borders between the content and the navigation, but this is the final step where we embed that structure into the content. So rather than having a navigation structure separate, we bring them together on the page. What's really important is this comes back to this winners one thing, right? We have to be consistent. We have to be consistent within ourselves, but we also have to be consistent with the other applications, and that will create confidence from our users. They've learnt how to use one application, they come to our application, and they immediately recognise how to manipulate our content, how to use the standard elements like the charms bar and the search bar on our app. There's a bunch of standard gestures available to us. They're probably self-explanatory. The interesting one is swipe to select. This is interesting. People usually discover this one by accident, right? So that little, if I drag it off, I'm doing drag, right? But if I do that little sort of little swipe in the opposite, in the transverse direction to the scroll, then I'm doing a swipe to select. That's one that people don't discover initially. Maybe that's okay. Maybe you would argue for the start screen. I don't mind if it takes you a week or so before you realize that there's a way to unpin elements from the start screen, for example. And so you could argue that this is a good example of what we call functional layering. You might also say that users will find that when they're ready. Surely there must be some way to remove these things. And maybe at that point they start mucking around. But what we've done in some of our apps is try to avoid this where we can. And oftentimes it's a simple case of rather than having a select function here and a command down the bottom, just drill into that content and then provide the command in the app bar for that specific content is just as good. It's an extra tap, but it's much easier to find. 10 minutes. Well, that's better than I thought. Awesome. So we shouldn't have buttons on the page if we can help it. There are some exceptions to that rule. Microsoft gives us all a great big out and says that if basically the page is useless without the button, then we're allowed to put the button on the page. You can take that to court and argue that one out. There is that exception. So they're saying for commit that home loan application possibly deserves to be on the page. For example, I just made that example up, but that would, I presume, would be an example of what they mean. Certain interactions belong in the charms bar. The ones to look out for are those ones down the bottom. Help, sign in, sign out, contact information, all your terms and privacy. And in fact, Microsoft, when you submit, is looking for that stuff. So the stuff down the bottom, the contact information and your terms and conditions, if that's not in the settings, that's one of the reasons they'll reject you at certification. Sign in and sign out shouldn't be in the app. They should be in the settings charm. That's another thing that people are going to have to learn. eBay, interestingly, violates that rule somewhat. They don't have the login. They don't have the login controls on the page, but they have a great big sign-in tile which opens the settings panel. eBay was an early app as well, so I don't. If they went through certification again today, I can't say what whether they'd get pinged for that or not. One of the applications we're working on at the moment basically is that. The app is completely non-functional until you've signed in. So we have provided sign-in right on the front page. There is literally a password, username and password on the front page. We went through Microsoft review. They tried to talk us out of it. I'm hesitating here because I don't want you. Please don't use my example as some sort of precedent. But the argument that we made was that the app is used. You know, there's nothing for us to do until someone signed in. They tried to suggest maybe we could have some sort of generic content instead, but that just distracted users from the purpose of the app. Sorry, I can't say what it is. And so they've let us off the hook on that one. I feel nervous about saying that because I don't want you all to go away and say, it'll be okay. Shane said.
just to add to that, Live SDK version 5.0, which is for the Windows 8 apps, does recommend you actually do that. And they do say you have to put the username and password because that's
right.
So, and
Are you saying you might have found an inconsistency in Microsoft advice? Well, remember that URL. It might come in handy later on. I'm going to keep going, guys. Sorry. I just want to see if I can get through a bit more of this content before I run out of time. Some commands don't belong in the app bar. As I said, ones that are just necessary to complete the task you're allowed to put on the main screen. Just a note, cut, copy, and paste are supposed to go in context menus. Tap and hold, and they pop up. Microsoft encourages us to make other use of context menus. Context menus are fine. They have a big problem that they're hard to discover, right? It doesn't occur to people that if I press and hold on content, more options are going to pop up. So we really want to reserve those context menus either for shortcuts, so something you could do another way, but here's a nice shortcut for an advanced user, or for stuff that really, the app is perfectly, usable without. I guess the other important thing to say about app bars is that we can and should use other widgets in what are called flyouts here. So in order to keep the app bar, not quite so busy, instead of having three sort options, you'll have a single sort option that pops up a flyout. So this is where we can and should use other widgets like text boxes and stuff like that, driven off app bar buttons. We talked about the app bar can be in the top as well, and we can do what we want in terms of layout at the top, but the only things we're allowed to put in the app bar at the bottom is those buttons. And I've just realized this is a bad example because, of course, IE has a text box down the bottom. They broke their own rules. Imagine that. I said there's a bunch of controls. There's heaps of guidance about the controls themselves. As I said yesterday, they tend to be pretty ugly. So use them sparingly. But they're all there for you to use. Be aware that if you're designing for touch, there's a sweet spot on either side of the tablet where thumbs, can get to most easily. So as you lay out your content on the page, think about where what content you should put, the content that people are most likely to need to manipulate, and can you arrange the page so that the bulk of the content is in easy reach from either sides of a tablet, particularly if you're designing for a mobile scenario. Not all of us are, of course. So I've only got a few minutes to talk about visuals. I'll just talk about this silhouette part, because this is really important. It's possibly something that doesn't immediately occur to you. If you look carefully at a whole bunch of apps, you'll see that there's an outline shape to a Metro app on Windows 8 that's very consistent. And it's about the margin at the top and the margin at the left, and the margin, lesser so, but also the margin at the bottom. And Microsoft refers to that as the C-shaped silhouette. And I'd really want to encourage you to stick to that silhouette. It's very tempting to fill this stuff with content. It's extra pixels. I can put more stuff in. But this is about looking like you belong on the platform. And that extra bit of white space just gives the user sort of a moment to breathe, or gives your content a moment to breathe, might be a better way to put it. So just avoid the temptation to fill that space. You can scroll stuff into that left margin, by the way, of course. But when you first arrive, 120 pixels down the left there. And so the templates that they give us in Visual Studio and in Blend all comply to those rules. So if you're using, if you're starting from Visual Studio, pull up one of the templates. Whether or not you intend to use it as you're starting to start your actual application, just using some of the template applications just so you can check sort of layout. So there's the margins there, 100 at the top, 140 till the content starts, 120 on the left, unless you're in snap mode. Can you tell I've been worrying about these things? You can see how the same silhouette applies across all of them. And as you drill into those templates, you'll also see that the grid starts to apply. So there's a 20-pixel grid going on. And you'll be surprised that grid is being applied throughout the entire application. So right down into the deep depths of the content, that 20-pixel grid is being complied with. Why is that so important? By following those rules, we look like we belong. Even though it's a subconscious thing and users possibly will never consciously register whether or not your app is on the grid or not, by sticking to that grid, it helps all our apps adopt a consistent visual style. So up on the website, there's a bunch of examples of how to apply that grid and all the rules and regulations around them. I think I might have to stop. Let me just fast forward to the one important slide about type, and then I'm going to have to stop, guys. And that's fonts, because this question comes up often. Unless you've got a particular brand font that you need to use for the heading, you know, the font we're all using is Sego UI. But if you're doing content specifically for reading, like large documents, we should use the Cambria font, which has little feet on it, little serifs. And halfway between, if it's content that people need to read and write, they're recommending the Calibri font. They're just a little bit easier for detailed reading than Sego font. Don't use Sego Lite unless you're more than 20 points. Apologies, guys. I should stop there. We did sort of miss out on maybe 10 slides towards the end. Let me just fast forward to the end. All the slides are up, so by all means, have a look through those. And there's a little bit more about use of type and stuff like that. No time for questions, but I'll hang around here and I'll head over to the speaker's lounge after this to take questions. Apologies for that little rush at the end, but thanks for coming along. Thanks for sticking it out. Hey, man.